Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and legacy of one of the great explorers, Ernest Shackleton. And we'll be finding out why he's considered one of the most brilliant and charismatic leaders during the heroic age of polar exploration. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text to 53106. Text costs 30 cents. Or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we heard about the mixtape NASA sent into space, found out about an Irish adventurer in South America in the 19th century, and investigated the impact of a tragic murder during the Troubles, all in our February book show. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website newstalk.com or wherever you download your podcasts. The Irish Legal History Society will be having its spring discourse online on Friday the 26th of March. Three papers by leading experts on the constitutional changes in Ireland and Northern Ireland in the years 1920 to 1922. It'll be free to watch, and details will be on the Irish Legal History Society's webpage and on Eventbrite, and that'll all be going up later this week. Now, tonight's debate is on Ernest Shackleton. Born in Kildare in 1874, Shackleton joined the White Star Line as an officer cadet in 1890 and volunteered to join the Antarctic expedition 10 years later. Appointed third officer under the command of Captain Robert Scott, he sailed for the Antarctic in July 1901 on the ship Discovery, and the crew included Tom Crean. As David Murphy writes in the Royal Irish Academy's Dictionary of Irish Biography, Shackleton found it difficult to deal with Scott's authoritarian manner, and the two men clashed frequently. Shackleton took part in the Southern Journey with Scott in 1902 before returning home with ill health in 1903. He became a hero in Britain and Ireland when he returned from a second expedition in 1909 and was knighted for his efforts, but it is for his third expedition between 1914 and 1916 that he is perhaps best remembered. Following the abandonment of their ship Endurance when it was crushed by ice, Shackleton showed great courage in leading the rescue of the men who were stranded. Shackleton died of a heart attack in 1922 while on a fourth mission to the Antarctic, and he was buried at the Whaling Station Cemetery on South Georgia. Considered one of the great figures in the heroic age of exploration, in tonight's show we want to explore his life and his legacy, and to do that I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Michael Smith is a leading expert on polar exploration, and his books include Shackleton, By Endurance We Conquer, and Great Endeavour, Ireland's Antarctic Explorers. Camilla Nicol is a geologist and museum curator and is the chief executive of the United Kingdom Antarctic Heritage Trust. Trevor Cornford is the chairman of the Polar Postal History Society of Great Britain. Kevin Kenny is director of the Athy Heritage Centre Shackleton Museum, as well as being director of the Ernest Shackleton Shackleton Autumn School. Professor Julian Dowdswell is the director of the Scott Polar Research Institute and professor of physical geography at the University of Cambridge. And he's co-author of Ernest Shackleton, Antarctic Explorer. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Charlotte Connolly, the curator of the Polar Museum at the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge. And Michael, I might begin with you. And I might begin with a broad question about Shackleton and how he is, even today in the 21st century, considered one of the great leaders and someone who you can draw inspiration from and draw example from. Because I'm just looking at books that have been published recently about leadership lessons you can learn from Shackleton. There's one here recently published called Shackleton's Way, Leadership Lessons from the Great Antarctic Explorer. Another one, Shackleton, Leadership Lessons from Antarctica. Another one, Leading at the Edge, Leadership Lessons from the Limits of Human Endurance, the extraordinary saga of Shackleton's Antarctic expedition. And they're just three. There's a huge interest in the Shackleton story, and there's a huge interest in applying life lessons from the Shackleton story.
Yes, good evening. It is a remarkable life in many ways, but of course you can't escape the reality that this is a very modern phenomenon. The idea that Shackleton has always been this hero and people writing books about things like his leadership is completely different to the reality. For almost 50 years after his death, he was a really marginalized figure in history. This is a very new phenomenon. And in some respects, I find it quite funny that he's being lauded by sort of business schools, and think in America in particular, for his sort of management. He really, in business terms, he couldn't run a bath. He was absolutely hopeless. But get him on the ice, and now you're talking about a completely different character. And I think, as a biographer, the thing which leaps out at you about Shackleton is that there were, in effect, two Shackletons. And I don't mean for a second to suggest that he was schizophrenic. He wasn't. But the man at home was completely different to the man on the ice. On the ice, he was assured, he was calm, he was measured, and he inspired people to do things which they might not otherwise do. His men loved him to bits, but at home he was a completely different character. You know, his business ventures, as I mentioned, were a complete failure. His marriage was difficult, to say the least. He had a string of affairs. Every business venture that he tried fell apart. And yet, by the 1980s, he suddenly comes back into vogue. And it's almost, in historical terms, as though society couldn't live with two great polar explorers, that Captain Scott, in many respects, dominated the first part of the 20th century, and Shackleton has now replaced him and come along as the man we all turn to. But he is unquestionably a compelling figure, and in my view, one of the great explorers of all time.
And it's fascinating the way you describe the two Shackletons there, the person who you could trust when you're on the ice, but who you wouldn't take your eyes off him if he was visiting your wife, or if he was managing your business, or if you're in partnership with him.
Well, it was said that you could trust Shackleton with your life, but not your money or your wife. And in many respects, that was true. But like I said, you have to always bear in mind, and from the biographer's point of view, he is absolutely wonderful character to delve into, because there were so many parts. He was a man of huge contradictions and paradoxes. But again, I come back to the point, get him on the ice and he's a completely different. He's sure-footed. He knows what he's doing. Strangely enough, he's a very cautious man on the ice. He doesn't take risks. But we have to put into context, these men were pioneers. It's very easy 100 years later to criticise the little things they did wrong, and they certainly did lots of things wrong. It's very easy to criticise, but these men were pioneers. And you know, just you mentioned in the introduction that Shackleton sails off to the Antarctic with Scott in 1901. It was only 6 years earlier that the first human footprints were left on the Antarctic continent. That's how much of a pioneer these men were. So I think we can forgive them for making mistakes, which they certainly did.
And Michael, in terms of his identity and even how he was perceived in his lifetime and afterwards, was he Irish, Anglo-Irish? How did the British perceive him? Did they see him as Irish? Did the Irish see him as English? How was he perceived both in his lifetime and afterwards?
Shackleton was always an outsider wherever he went. He's born into the Protestant ascendancy in Kildare, as you mentioned, in 1874. And so, in a sense, he's too English in Ireland. And then his father brings the family to London in the 1880s. And once he comes to England, he's too Irish in England. So he starts off as being an outsider. The establishment of the day didn't like Shackleton. The public warmed to him. He was very charismatic. He had a way with words. He was said to be one of the great speakers of the 20th century. And his men would walk through a brick wall for him. But the establishment didn't like him at all. And they pretty much went out of their way to make life difficult for him. They very rarely gave him any large sums of money. They lent him a few instruments. But they didn't support him in the way that, for example, they supported Captain Scott. That was just the way of things, that it was down to a few individuals. But Shackleton became a great explorer almost despite those impediments.
Fascinating. Julian, we've been talking about the ice and how you could trust Shackleton to lead you once you're on the ice. Let's talk about the ice and the Antarctic, because I believe you've been there and you know exactly what those conditions are like.
Good evening, Patrick. Yes, I've been to the Antarctic a number of times over a career of 30, 35 years. I'm a glaciologist by background, so my field of study is ice and snow and climate change. The Antarctic is by far the most difficult place to get to in the world. It's a huge area of wilderness. It's 99% covered by ice. The ice is up to almost a maximum of 5 kilometres in thickness. On average, the Antarctic continent and, of course, the South Pole itself sits at almost 10,000 feet or 3,000 metres high. A large part of Antarctica is a higher plateau. It's the coldest place in the world. It's the driest place in the world. And as Douglas Mawson, who was on Shackleton's Nimrod expedition, coined the phrase in the title of his book, Home of the Blizzard, it's also the windiest place in the world. And one of my scientific colleagues in the US, analysing data from Commonwealth Bay on the Antarctic coast, demonstrated that unequivocally a few years ago. So it's an extremely harsh environment, the harshest on Earth. And as has been indicated already, it wasn't until Scott's Discovery Expedition of 1901-4 that Scott, Shackleton and Edward Wilson first penetrated any distance into the interior of Antarctica. So literally, its interior has only been examined at all over the last century or so. And when Shackleton went south on each of his four expeditions, there was a lot of simple geographical exploring still to be done. The domes on the roof of the Scott Polar Research Institute indicate this very clearly. In 1934, when they were painted, there were still lots and lots of gaps, even in the location of the coast of Antarctica. So these people, Scott, Shackleton, Amundsen from Norway as well, were genuine first visitors and explorers to the continent of Antarctica.
And Julian, what was the attraction, or what was that? Was this like the equivalent at the turn of the century of putting someone on the moon? And it's also interesting the way, when we're talking about Shackleton, it's also a story of failure or a story of successive failures, but yet it's still something that's celebrated.
I think it's the challenge, and I mean, and it's not just the challenge of doing something fast, it's the challenge really of doing something for the first time and actually mapping the unknown. And I think your analogy of space travel is a very, very good one. I mean, it's fair to say that parts of Antarctica, even today, the areas beneath the floating ice shelves that fringe much of Antarctica, those areas are much less well mapped than the surface of a planet such as Venus. So there is a lot we still don't know scientifically about Antarctica, indeed, and how it will respond in the future to environmental change. And I think that the expeditions of the so-called heroic era of Scott and Shackleton had dual aims, in part to explore the Antarctic and to map it and to try and understand it, because they took a variety of scientists with them. The early expeditions were in many ways a model for the beginnings of interdisciplinary science in Antarctica, which we see supported today by the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research. And that's one side of the expeditions. The other side is really the challenge of getting there first. And I think it is clear that Scott, Shackleton and Amundsen all wanted to be the first people to get to the South Pole.
Camilla, when we look at his legacy, when we look at what he contributed to the history of Antarctica and to exploration, how significant a figure is he? Is he the person who's helping to in a way, put Antarctica on the map in terms of the popular consciousness?
Good evening, thank you. Shackleton is kind of this universal figure, a hero, I suppose. And I think, as Michael was saying, that popularity has certainly grown significantly in the last 30, 40 years. But certainly, even upon his return from the first expedition that he led in 1907 to 1909, he was a showman. He knew how to, knew he had to, get in front of the press, get in front of people, tell his story. He still had a lot of money to raise, of course, after that expedition. But getting out there, telling his story, he was a great public speaker, as I think was said earlier. So he really did. He was a very visible Antarctic explorer at the turn of the century, and that was different in a way to Scott, who was a much more British hero, if you like. He was a military man. He was there. It was much more about the science as well as the geographical accomplishments, if you like. But Shackleton was very much there, out there, telling his story, publishing books. Of course, you know, he took his diaries and turned them into books. So a very important and visible figure. And I think since then, yes, his reputation declined a little through the 20th century, but certainly since then, his reputation has travelled the world. You know, you can see across the world, Americans, the Chinese, people all over the world are very interested in him. They are inspired by him. And as I think was mentioned earlier, you know, he's taught at the Harvard Business School, and there are endless books written about him. So he has a very important legacy, not only for the things he achieved, but also things he didn't achieve and how he dealt with them. And I think that has been a really interesting thing since in the 100-odd years since he died.
And Camilla, do you think that's in part a lot to do with that expedition 1914-16 and the kind of the extraordinary rescue mission and the kind of the heroic tale of rescue against all odds that this is the case study for courage under fire?
Indeed, I think, I mean, it's one of the greatest stories ever told, isn't it? It's claiming a victory from the jaws of defeat in extraordinary fashion, losing pretty much everything, having to change your plans at every single turn. I mean, not just losing your ship and then just having to find a way home, but finding obstacles at every moment and having to change tack, making decisions. You know, unpopular decisions, but the fact that he was such a great leader of his men, he was loved by his men, they would do anything for him, but he wasn't afraid to make unpopular and difficult decisions. And legendarily he took the men who were least popular with him in the boat to South Georgia. So that expedition certainly did, and still does inspire people. And I think as a story and as bringing his men, his 27 men home, in good order, I think is quite remarkable. And I think, has probably not been surpassed as a act of heroism, I think, since.
Kevin, I hope in some day in the not so distant future, when things have changed in the world, I'll be able to take a journey down to Athy and visit the Shackleton Museum and also see that new Shackleton statue that I think was erected in 2016. And I'm just interested to know how Shackleton is viewed in County Kildare.
Yeah, sure. Good evening, Patrick, and consider yourself invited down anyway. Good evening, everybody. I suppose Shackleton, from a starting point, is better known outside of Ireland than he is within Ireland. I think we have, over the last years, we have built up a lot of awareness, and it's one of our focuses in the Shackleton Museum to build up awareness, beginning with local, county and national. I think the Shackletons themselves, arrived in Kildare in the Quaker settlement in Ballytor in the early 1700s, where they were educationalists. So it was a multi-denominational, multi-gender school that they ran. And I know the word ascendancy was used earlier, but they weren't particularly. It was educationalists. Then his father, had leased a farm from the Duke of Leinster. So I think in lots of ways, Shackleton is seen as iconic and a real reason to be proud within Kildare. And, we've seen that with, the statue. It's been accepted, totally accepted. It's the Instagram point in the town, I'm told. And I think within the county and increasingly in the country, he is recognised for what he is, which was, Professor David, in giving a summary of Shackleton in a speech in Adelaide in, I think, about 1909, he was asked, where is he from? And he said, he's Irish, from the crown of his head to the soles of his feet. He portrays the best characteristics of the race.
Very interesting. And Kevin, it's interesting the way the Shackleton family left Ireland, I think around 1884, and moved to London. And was there a... was there a what was their view of their Irish roots? And I know in later years, in between some of these expeditions, he ran for Parliament, I think in Dundee, as a Liberal Unionist, unsuccessful in that. I don't know how good he would have been in the Commons, although as we've heard, he was a fantastic speaker. In terms of those connections, was the leaving of Ireland significant?
Well, I think his father, when he qualified, his father, the family, he had a growing family, and there was a lot of land agitation and so on in the 1870s, 1880s. So he returned to Trinity College and studied medicine. He did look to set up in Dublin, but didn't get an opening, and moved to London then and set up in Sydenham, where just interestingly, Eleanor Marks was one of his patients. He attended her on her death. Shackleton's father looked quite like Parnell, like Charles Stewart Parnell, and he was a home ruler. And I think Ernest Standing in Dundee, at that stage he was secretary of the Royal Scottish Geographical Society, which he had quite revolutionised, actually, when he got on board there in terms of finances, membership and so on. And I think, he was opportunistic, and this was a chance to give himself standing and get himself in with various people who would later sponsor expeditions, and it worked. So in terms of his Irishness, they definitely, there's still a strong branch of the family in Ireland. Emily Shackleton, writing to his first biographer, Hugh Robert Mill, said he called himself Irish. Shackleton called himself Irish in the Magellan Times, reporting on one of his rescue attempts on the Endurance Expedition. He's put down as an Irish explorer. His nationality is. The ship was laid up in Cork in one of his early merchant seaman expeditions. He visited his relations in Moon. And then later in 1909, he came to Ireland, was introduced to a crowd as an Irish man, and spoke in Earlsford Terrace and the Rotunda. So I don't think he was probably an internationalist in his head. He got on with everybody, but he was happy to be Irish.
Very good. Trevor, now we really wanted to have you on, Trevor, because there's some fascinating work that your society does in terms of the correspondence of this period and in terms of things like postcards and letters and stamps, and how from things like that you can get a really interesting insight into the period and the people.
Yes, indeed. I consider myself a polar collector, not an erudite student of all of Shackleton's exploits, but our society itself was formed over 50 years ago by a philatelist, and eventually it became much more concentrated on the correspondence coming to and from expeditions. That carries right through what I consider the heroic age, has been mentioned already, up to 1922 personally for me, because that's when Shackleton died. And it has continued obviously beyond that, but as a collector you have to concentrate somewhere, because it's far too huge a field of collecting to do everything.
And you do get an insight into, I think, Shackleton's personality, his temperament, his relationships from these materials.
Yes, I think I've brought a couple of things to mind of interest that might illustrate some of those thoughts and characteristics, which some of your other panel might be talking about as well. It seems to me, as a collector, when you're trying to find material to put in your displays, I actually exhibit as well. I give talks to, for instance, philatelic societies, and also occasionally to non-philatelic organisations like the Rotary. Again, talking, as previous speakers have mentioned, about his leadership qualities. But the interesting thing for me is he was, as been said, an understudy effectively on Scott's first expedition on the Discovery from 1901. He was invalided home in 1903, which started, I think, let's call it rivalry between himself and Scott, because he was upset at being sent home, because Scott deemed him to be not well enough to stand another year in the Antarctic after the return on their southern journey. It was a very strenuous and debilitating journey for all three of them. The interesting thing is that, if you want to talk about what my interest, on that expedition, Scott was given a label. We couldn't call it a stamp, but it was a label with an emblem on it which said National Antarctic Expedition. And the various members of the scientists, not so much crew, and the officers of the largely naval-sponsored expedition. I would add, by the by, that Scott was always an official expedition. He went with government support, the Navy provided staff, the Royal and the Royal Geographic Society also provided many instruments. Shackleton was always on a private mission. And that's one of the big things that people have to bear in mind when they try and compare these two guys. But this label, Shackleton, from my studies, appears to have been given responsibility for handing them out, addressing certain envelopes as thank yous or souvenirs to the agent in New Zealand for Scott's expedition. And in 1907, when Shackleton went down to New Zealand for the Nimrod expedition, it appears to me he thought, well, I can do something better than this. And he approached the post office in New Zealand and said, how about you print me some penny stamps which are valid for postage with the name of where I'm going? And that was the King Edward the Seventh Land, which had already been named, and where he was going to have his base. So he was very aware, I think, as people know, about the publicity aspect, and also of looking after people that could help him. And even the Prime Minister of New Zealand was involved in this escapade of printing special stamps up for Shackleton to take with him. And believe it or not, for a penny, you could write from the Antarctic, the Nimrod would bring it back to New Zealand and post it to anywhere within the Empire and Great Britain.
Michael, that is fascinating. And the private dimension, that these being these private missions, because it shows how Shackleton had to be a kind of a PR marketing man as well, because he had to inspire people with his vision so that they would back it financially.
Absolutely, without any question. He was well ahead of his time as a PR man. I mean, he did things which today would be normal. He basically got sponsors. And he sold the rights to the expedition's books and films to outlets such as publishers before he went. So he got money up front and said, when I come back, I'll write you a book about where I've been and what I've done. And these things were very, very useful. And, of course, some of the film brought back from the Endurance expedition is some of the most remarkable film footage ever taken, dramatic pictures of that expedition. He saw the way things were going. The stamp collecting thing, which Trevor mentions, this was partly a money-making operation, but it was, as he said, it was partly a means of getting his name out there. And, you know, there's one little episode which I always love to tell. When he eventually rescued the men from Elephant Island, they were taken back on ship in August, early September of 1916, and they were paraded at Punta Arenas in South America. And he asked them all before they got off the ship, don't have a shave, don't have a wash. I want the world to see you like you were, because obviously it was a far better image. And that's the sort of thing now that people call photo opportunities. It was a far better image to have these 22 castaways wearing their dirty clothes and unshaven after a year than it was to have them all spruced up with smiles on their faces. So he was a man ahead of his time, and he exploited, quite ruthlessly exploited, the newspapers of the day and publishers effectively to finance his expeditions. And all the other money was raised from benefactors, people who were philanthropists, people who saw the benefit of sending people down to the Antarctic. And of course, his last expedition where he died, the quest, was financed by a very, very rich man called Rowett, who actually used to live near where I live in England. And unfortunately, he was a very, very rich businessman, and he gave Shackleton a huge amount of money for the time to go to the Antarctic. Well, Shackleton died on the expedition, and poor old Rowett, who was a school friend, committed suicide a few years later. So it was a tragic connection, but it was the only time in his life that Shackleton had any money.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Charlotte Connolly, the curator of the Polar Museum, about some of the instruments of this era and indeed some of their collections. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Talking history. On News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the life and legacy of Ernest Shackleton. I'm delighted to be joined now by Charlotte Connolly, who's the curator of the Polar Museum at the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge, and she's an historian of science and technology. Charlotte, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell me about this wonderful project, By Endurance We Conquer, the Shackleton Project, and some of the materials you have in your collection at the Polar Museum?
Yeah, so we were very lucky to be recipients of a grant from the National Lottery Heritage Fund that meant that we could purchase objects and artefacts related to Shackleton over a period of 5 years, which is quite unusual for museums. Often we find that we're very grateful for the donations that we receive, but we don't always have much money available to actually buy things at auction. So over the course of 5 years, that's exactly what we did. We kept our eyes peeled for anything to do with Shackleton. And it was over a centenary period as well, so we knew that there'd be a lot of interest. And we were able to add quite a number of things to our collection, which means that they're now accessible to the public through our museum, which of course is closed at the moment, but will be reopened at some point.
And one of the objects that you have is a barometer, and that's believed to have been used during one of Shackleton's expeditions.
Yeah, so the barometer that we acquired was used by Edgeworth David, who was an Australian geologist. And he travelled to Antarctica on the Nimrod expedition, more properly known as the British Antarctic Expedition of 1907-09. And one of the achievements of that expedition was that they were the first people to complete an ascent of Mount Erebus in Antarctica. And Mount Erebus is a live volcano, so it was quite an exciting trip for everyone involved.
So in a way, you get an insight through the collection into not just Shackleton, but also some of the less well-known expedition members.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. The way we talk about polar history has historically been through these kind of heroic figures. Shackleton, of course, Captain Scott. But there were loads of people who went on the expeditions with them. And so we think it's really important to make sure that we tell their stories as well.
And it's fascinating as well, the way, and your own work on the scientific instruments, that you can actually tell a lot of the story and a different part of the story by studying these historic scientific instruments.
That's right. Again, we've got this kind of heroic way that we tell these stories, and it's about the first. So Shackleton spent a lot of his time trying to be the first to the South Pole, and then when someone else got there before him, to be the first to cross Antarctica. But they were doing amazing work all along. So Edgeworth David, as I said, he was a geologist. He also led an expedition to reach the South Magnetic Pole on this same expedition. And the instruments really give a bit of a story into the other things that they were up to, as well as this kind of grabbing bits of the map and getting there before anyone else had been there.
And why do you think the story of people like Ernest Shackleton still resonates today? Why does it still inspire and enthrall people?
Well, I think because it's still such a remarkable set of achievements. And perhaps also because Antarctica is so far away and so alien to almost everybody. But they really did achieve remarkable things, and with only what they could pack and take with them. We're so used today, I think, to being always connected, and the idea that you could go somewhere where you really, there was no one coming to help you if you got into any kind of difficulty it's really kind of unusual today. And I think that's part of what resonates is, it's all about how they survived in those conditions.
Okay, well, Charlotte, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Charlotte Connolly, the curator of the Polar Museum at the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge. And it's somewhere that hopefully we'll be able to visit not too long from now. Charlotte, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more on the life and legacy of Ernest Shackleton right after this.
Talking history on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the life and the legacy of Ernest Shackleton. I'm joined by a brilliant panel of experts, Michael Smith, Camilla Nicol, Trevor Cornford, Kevin Kenny, Professor Julian Dowdswell, and earlier there we just talked to Charlotte Connolly. Now, Julian, I want to talk about that, the expedition 1914 to 1917, the loss of the Endurance, and then that extraordinary rescue mission. What went wrong, and just how was Shackleton able to bring together this rescue mission?
Well, when Shackleton got the money for his expedition, as Michael has said, it was always a very tricky thing to do that, and he got as far as South Georgia and called in at the whaling station there on his way down, and the Norwegian whalers there who observed the sea ice of the Weddell Sea very, very carefully, and they had a long-term memory of what the sea ice conditions were like, basically shook their heads and said, it's a very bad year this year, maybe you should come back next year. And of course, no expeditioner, whether it's today and whether it's a research grant that I have or whether it's Shackleton 100 years or so ago, is in a position to be able to come back next year. You're there and you have to have a go. And so Shackleton went south with the Endurance, and indeed they found that the sea ice conditions were very difficult indeed in the Weddell Sea. The Weddell Sea remains today one of the most difficult places to operate in the world. I was on an ice-breaking research vessel with two aims a couple of years ago. One was science, the other was to try and find the wreck of Shackleton's Endurance. Very difficult place to operate. We were over the wreck site for about one day and then had to abandon that attempt. But Shackleton carried on south. He had an opportunity to go ashore somewhere short of where his preferred starting point to undertake the crossing of Antarctica would have been, and they decided to carry on. And the ship was then beset or stuck in the ice for a number of months and drifted clockwise through the Weddell Sea. To start with, the ship was intact, and then gradually, as the pressure of the sea ice built up, the ship was firstly started to leak, and then had to be abandoned. And the party abandoned the ship, and were all 28 of them were on the ice with the three small whaling boats only, and they watched as their ship sank. We actually hold Shackleton's original diaries in the Scott Polar Research Institute, and Shackleton's description of the sinking of the Endurance and the crushing of the ship is a very moving and powerful one. One really gets the feeling of isolation where the great ship that they were on has sunk, and they're there with the three whaling boats. So they were there on the ice. The ice is drifting north, and of course, one of the tricky things was to keep morale up at that point, and Shackleton did that very expertly. He took, indeed, some of the more difficult members of the expedition into his own tent to keep an eye on them, and he famously made drinks and came round with cocoa in the morning at different times, kept morale up. And eventually, their little camp and the three whaling boats, they started to feel the ocean as they drifted north. The sea ice began to break up, and they went in the three little boats in search, hopefully, of whaling people who might be able to rescue them. And they ended up, after a very, very difficult journey where the boats were separated for a while, on this rock on the edge of Antarctica, basically, called Elephant Island. They landed in one place which was unsuitable. They came round a cape, landed at another place. And after surveying that, Crean, Shackleton, and Frank Worsley and Frank Wild decided really that this was little more than a storm beach, and although they could camp there and indeed kill penguins and live there on that food for a while, if they stayed there, they were just simply likely to die there. So Shackleton hatched the plan of taking one of those three whaling boats, just 23 feet long, with the gunwales made up by the carpenter McNeish. He picked six of them, including the Irishman Tom Crean, to go on that epic 800-mile boat journey across the most fearsome seas in the world between Elephant Island and South Georgia. And there are some wonderful pictures taken by Frank Hurley of that little boat leaving. One can only assume that the 22 men who were left there really thought, are we ever going to see them again? Shackleton indeed wrote instructions to Frank Wild, who maintained leadership of the expedition. The 22 members left on Elephant Island. We hold that document in the Scott Polar Research Institute too. And he wrote that diary saying how he wanted the expedition to be written up effectively in the event of his death. And the six of them managed that 800-mile boat journey to South Georgia, an epic of seamanship. Frank Worsley was the man who navigated the Little James Caird. And the big worry, because the winds always come from the west, is if they missed the island, that was really the end of them. But they landed on the west coast of the island. Three of the party of six could go no further. But of course, the whaling stations are all on the east side of the island, and that's where they had to go to raise the alarm. So Shackleton, Worsley and Tom Crean set out across the island, across the almost completely unmapped island, the mountains of South Georgia, which rise to almost 10,000 feet, to almost 3,000 metres in height. And they had to get across this unmapped mountain chain in order to get to the whaling station. And there's a wonderful story of Shackleton, Crean and Worsley at the top of a great snow slope as the mist is coming down. And they realise that if they just stop and sleep, they will probably never wake up. And instead, they shook hands, sat on a coil of rope and just skidded off into the mist. And they could have been a crag, the three of them could have died, but they ended up about 1,000 feet down in a great heap in the snow, and then managed to walk into the whaling station. And one of the great quotes from Shackleton, when they approached the whaling station, he says, the sound of the siren going off in the morning at the whaling station was the first human sound apart from our own voices that we had heard for almost 3 years. And I think that gives you a very strong sense of their isolation. They walked into the whaling station where they discussed the sea ice with the whalers all those years before. And the man in charge of the whaling station, the Norwegian, simply did not recognize them. And when Shackleton, weather-beaten, bearded and so on, reintroduced himself, the captain of the whaling station hugged him. And of course, they provided the way for Shackleton to try and organise relief expedition to go back and rescue the 22 remaining on Elephant Island. There were four attempts to do that because the sea ice conditions were so bad that each of the previous three was beaten back. But eventually, the little Chilean vessel under the captaincy of Pilotto Pardo made it to Elephant Island through a gap in the sea ice. And again, Frank Hurley's wonderful photograph of the ship and the people waving from the island. And Shackleton came in on a little boat and asked if all was well. And they said all was well. And they were rescued. And that it remains today one of the most epic escapes and one of the most epic rescues ever undertaken, whether it's in the polar regions or elsewhere. And that is one of the main reasons why Shackleton is, I think, so revered as an explorer.
Camilla, an extraordinary story and told so brilliantly there by Julian. And I'm wondering, when you look at leadership and political leaders and other types of leaders throughout history, very often when they have an idea or a strategy, they stick to it no matter what. And even when things are going wrong, they're kind of determined to stick to that course. Whereas the genius of Shackleton is that he was able to adjust and change and come up with an entirely new plan.
Indeed, exactly that. I mean, I think Shackleton is known for having a plan A, plan B, plan C, and then to come up with a plan X when it was really needed. And I think that is a testament to his true leadership, that he was able to take his men with him on those decisions, to take on board the evidence before his eyes, you know, the conditions they're in, what they're needing to accomplish, and make the right choices. I mean, you know, in the 1907-1909 expedition, yeah, their goal was the pole, and you know, some 90 miles sort of adrift from the pole, he took the decision to turn around, and then of course, you know, all the decisions he had to make during the Transantarctic expedition and the rescue there, you know, phenomenal. But it's always being able to make good decisions, or even be able to change your mind if the conditions require you to, and be able to take your men with you and the people and, you know, your team with you. And I think that is something that perhaps political leaders maybe are maybe not quite so good at sometimes. And I think it's that driven by, you know, Shackleton's very much driven by, you know, keeping his men safe, you know, their well-being, making sure they could accomplish the goals that they could. But if he weren't going to accomplish the first goal, maybe we'll try something else. And in the event of the Transantarctic expedition, of course, it was to get his men home safely, or at least the Weddell Sea Party. So it was very much, you know, he's very much a leader that is known for, you know, those being in a tight corner, being in a tight spot and making the right call. I think today, people do look up to that, and see that as a really important, you know, set of leadership skills, really. And I think, you know, and that's why he's taught in the Harvard Business School and all these other places, and still scrutinised and written about today.
Michael, how important were Shackleton's men in terms of these missions? And, you know, we could do an entire show, and I think someday we should, on someone like Tom Crean. And when you've got some other remarkable figures, how much of it is Shackleton and how much of it is the team around him?
Well, I think Camilla touched on it there before. Shackleton's genius was his decision-making. He had an extraordinary ability to take the right decision at the right time, turning back from the South Pole in 1909, when he could have reached it, actually. He wouldn't have survived coming back, but he could have reached it. And his other area of genius for me was his ability to choose the men to work with. Not an easy thing to do, as anyone who's ever worked in business knows, that he picked men who weren't necessarily the ideal candidates on paper, but these were men like Tom Crean, Frank Wild. You could trust your life with these men. If you gave Tom Crean your life, he would cherish it for you. And the same with Frank Wild. And it was Shackleton's ability to pick these men. I mean, on the other end of the spectrum, completely the other end of the spectrum, Shackleton had no particular interest in science. It wasn't his subject. He didn't have the patience for science. Yet, four of the men that he took south with him ended up being knighted for their services to science. That was because he chose them. That was one of his great abilities, in my view. His genius was his ability to choose the right person for the right job at the right time. And again, as Camilla said, his ability to improvise. So if circumstances changed, he changed. And he could make these remarkable decisions, and of course, in choosing the right men for the right job at the right time, was part of that process. So these expeditions wouldn't really have succeeded in the same way without the likes of Wild and Crean and Bill Lashley and others who were with Scott, but the important thing was that they were chosen in the first place. You have to remember that for endurance expedition, Shackleton received 5,000 requests to go with him, and yet he pared it down to men, as I said, that you could trust your life with.
And Michael, looking at the later years then, the bad health, the problems with money, the complicated private life, what was driving him to return to the Antarctic? You know, if he had survived that final mission, would he have wanted to keep on going back? Those later years, and wasn't too much later because he died in 1922, there seemed to be something driving him that's hard to maybe pin down.
Absolutely. In many respects, Shackleton should never have been an explorer. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but we do know from the very first expedition on Discovery that he suffered from heart problems and breathing difficulties. And so he was never destined, it would seem, for a long life. But, of course, it was the wilderness where Shackleton came alive. I'm only happiest out there, is what he used to say. And it was only by going to the Antarctic, or he even toyed with the idea of going to the North Pole at one stage. But he really was only, he was at his happiest, and clearly, as we can see from just this discussion, that he just excelled on the ice. And as I said at the very beginning, there were two different Shackletons. The man on the ice was a giant. He was completely different to the man at home. On the ice, he was a genius. And he was, in my view, one of the great explorers of all time. Because he was a pioneer. And I think that Julian touched on it as well earlier when he was saying, you know, we shouldn't underestimate these men were pioneers. Just the ability to survive in the Antarctic, where nobody had been before, was an extraordinary achievement. And it was Shackleton's leadership and skill in improvising where necessary, which kept men alive and indeed led ultimately to the rescue of the people from Elephant Island.
And of course, after his death, I think he left his wife Emily with huge debts. She was happy to have him buried on South George. I didn't know whether that was that she was happy to see the back of him, or just that she realised that this was where he was happiest exploring there. But he really wasn't thinking about family when he was doing all of this.
One of Shackleton's extraordinary traits is that he was a man who never looked back, or indeed never looked sideways. He only ever focused on what was ahead. So he was always planning the next expedition. You know, literally on his deathbed, he didn't realize it was his deathbed, obviously, but as he was being treated for what turned out to be his last heart attack, he said to the doctor, "What do you want me to give up now?" Because he was looking ahead. He was a man who always looked ahead. And so for him, ahead was the wilderness. It was the Antarctic, or he may have gone to the Arctic. He didn't, as it happens, but he was toying with the idea. So he was always looking ahead. And I think Emily Shackleton, who's a long-suffering wife, I'm afraid, but she understood him. And she once said, "You can't tie an eagle in a barnyard." And she knew where he was happiest. And so she said, you know, bury him where he's happiest, surrounded by the mountains and the ice and by the people who manned the whaling stations. He was, you know, if you could have choreographed somebody's death, Shackleton's death and burial is a masterpiece.
Okay, well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Michael Smith, author of Shackleton by Endurance We Conquer, Camilla Nicol of the United Kingdom Antarctic Heritage Trust, Trevor Cornford of the Polar Postal History Society of Great Britain, Kevin Kenny of the Shackleton Museum, Professor Julian Dowdswell of the Scott Polar Research Institute, and Charlotte Connolly of the Polar Museum. Well, that is an end to another show. I will end with a quote from Shackleton. "The quality I look for most is optimism, especially optimism in the face of reverses and apparent defeat. Optimism is true moral courage." And I think we in Ireland, we all across the world, need moral courage more than ever. Almost 1 year into the pandemic, and a lot more to go, or perhaps a little bit more to go, but we don't give up in the face of reverses and apparent defeat. We will find the courage and we will carry on. My thanks to Susan Cahill, my producer, Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we'll be finding out about the artist Goya, the treasures of ancient Egypt, and lots more. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
Talking history on News Talk.